Session number 17679, Reel 2.
Peter Russell, Reel 2. How long is a stretch where you expected to be in the front line?
From memory, about 6 to 8 weeks. And I remember vividly we came out at Christmas of 52. I say Christmas. Actually, I think it was January the 7th, actually, when we came out. But we were in the line at Christmas time.
Was anything special done for you at Christmas?
No, all our Christmas parties was when we came out, you know. It was funny because it's throwback to the old World War One. We used to get a rum ration, and we had a sergeant, actually, Stan Burgess. He got killed too, actually. Stan Burgess, and he had this stone jar, and he said, "Well, why don't we just keep all the rum, and when we get back into reserve, we can have a good drink, you know?" So I thought, yeah, that's not a bad idea, Stan, you know. And when we actually moved out, I was on top of this Oxford carrier and had this great big stone jar of rum, you know. And I was right by the engine. It was nice and warm. And I thought, well, I'll try some of this, you know. And I started drinking it and drinking it and drinking it. And I was virtually legless. And when I got out of this carrier, I fell down. And I always remember a bloke called Tiddler Finch. We had a quartermaster sergeant called Tiddler Finch, and he saved my bacon, actually, because he said, this officer said, "What's the matter with that man? He's drunk." So said, no sir, that was the fumes from the engine, because he knew it was be a quartermaster offence, like, you know. The old Tiddler saved your bacon, actually. He was a real character. He was in the army, in the occupation army in the First World War with the Fusiliers, and he'd been to Korea as a quartermaster with the Middlesex. And I said to him, because you're a real old soldier, you know, I said, "Well, Tiddler, why do you..." Because when you're in the line, it's different to barracks, when it's everyone's yes sir, no sir, free bags. But when you're in the line, I mean, you could speak to them like normal. And I said, "Well, why'd you come back, Tiddler? You know, you're pushing your luck." He said, "Well, last time I came back," he said, "first time I came here," he said, "I made 600 quid, which was a lot of money, you know. And this time," he said, "I'm going to get 1,000 quid. He just came back for the money. He's on the fiddle, obviously, you know what I mean.
But what kind of fiddles could he have?
Well, you could sell anything there, you know. He could. When you went back, you could sell jerseys for a start, and other things you could sell. He used to have a terrific racket going, because we, you know, the British Army, we had always had a wet canteen. The Americans was always dry. Well, what they used to do, they just have a chip, and it's the right hand pencil. And he's go back and buy this Japanese beer, so 800 cases of SI beer, or they buy 1,000 cases. And on the way back, they drove off his American camp, say, you lads want any beer? Yeah. And he used to charge them through the nose for it, you know. And of course, when they got back to up the line, then they used to say, "Well, when we're in reserve," they used to say, "How many cases do you have?" "Oh, he only had 400. It was all in pencils. He just grabbed it out.
Did anybody...
If they knew about it, they didn't sort of say it. I think everyone was in it, you know what I mean? It was a sort of those, everyone, it was a secret, but everyone knew about it.
But when you knew it was your turn to go into the front line, did you dread it, or did you just accept it?
No, we just accepted it, really. I mean, because you would, I'd say it was all a crowd, and you just went in. I mean, you wouldn't dream of saying, "Well, I'm not going to go in." I mean, you know, I'd probably too much of a coward to say I wouldn't go in. Like, you know what I mean? You would. You couldn't not go in. No. I mean, although I met guys who we used to have, you know, some of the lads. I mean, they used to be, you just, when we went in, they would sit there and they would shake. You know. Some would cry, because, you know, we sort of we carried them, you know, that was it, really, you know. Just,
was this the effect of bombardment or what?
No, I think
or
I
just
think,
anticipation.
No, the thing is, when you're in the line, you're awake 24 hours a day. I mean, although you're asleep, you're awake. I mean, I could wake up in a fraction of a second. You had to, you know. We used to have a guy called Gaines, actually, he was a Lance Corporal, And he was so active, when we put him on a shake, like to wake him up to go on guard, two of us had to go, and one had to hold his shoulders down and one had to touch his head, because he was so quick. And he said, this old American 45, he'd go like this and have the gun at your head if you didn't watch out, like, you know. Everyone was sort of really hyperactive, you know. I tell you what happened at the dog B company. The first time we're in their line, that someone must have read about the First World War, and we used to get these old tins, you know, and put stones in them and put them on the wire, on the barbed wire. Because what they didn't realise, of course, when the wind when the wind came, of course it rustled, and these guys, it was B company. They threw 106 grenades and there was no one there. That's everyone got trigger out, but they was firing. Everyone said, "What the hell are they firing at? There's nothing there, you know." But they thought there's someone there, you know. But after a while, you know, a couple of 3 days, you pick it up. If you don't, I mean, there was a good friend of mine actually. Well, I say a good friend of guy I did my basic training with. A good friend of Charlie's actually. He went in as a marker, same as I did, like the lead guys in, you know. And this, I think he was with. Someone was doing a patrol, I can't remember exactly who it was. Paddy, his name was Paddy Waters, anyway. And he went out on a patrol with his guys. I mean, and he'd been in line about a day. His first patrol, bang, he just got the duck, you know. I think he went out with the French Canadians, I think.
You mean he was killed?
Oh, yeah, Paddy was killed, yeah, outright. Yeah.
But he wasn't supposed to do that as a marker,
presumably. No, he wasn't. I think he just thought, well, you know, I'm going to do it. I might as well get the experience. But, you know, we was all choked, obviously. You know, I mean, the guy just went in and he came straight out, like, you know.
So, if you were in this tense state of having to be awake, as you put it, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
After several weeks, what state were you in by the time you came out?
When you came out, everyone relaxed. I mean, we used to sleep, and you know, we used to really unwind, you know, and they used to do crazy things, you know, like we used to get steamed out of your mind, really, you know, drink no drugs, never any drugs, just booze, you know, and just chat, and because the big thing about it, you used to go around and see all the guys from the rifle companies who you hadn't seen. I mean, if I was supporting, say, C company, I never saw any guys in dog company, you know. And we used to go and see who's still around, really, the guys you knew, like, good, because you always had good mates, you know. You had mates and very good mates, and you made sure the ones, you know, they're still around, you know.
Did the enemy ever try to do anything to increase the tense state of the opposing troops?
No, not as I can remember, you know, sort of psychological stuff, you mean?
Yeah.
No.
Could you keep healthy in the trenches, or were there any diseases or illnesses that were picked up?
Well, we were loads and loads of shots, you know, like jabs before we went in, yeah, and we obviously we had to keep going up and down the hill to pick up things like your basics, like your water for a start. We used to carry these 5 gallon jerry cans of fresh water, I mean, because to wash in and drink and everything, you know, and bring up your food, you know. We used to have American curry rations in, like, the little boxes anyway, and we used to always have one hot meal a night, actually, either beer, sort of like a pork chop or steak or something like that, you know. Because the old Yanks used to fly in the food, you know. It was terrible, really. They used to fly in the food, didn't they? Fly out the bodies, because even then they was taking them out in rubber bags, you know. Crazy. Must have cost them a fortune, I think, the war.
So you never fell ill in Korea, then?
No, I put a lot of weight on. You know, I put a fair weight, even what I've got now. No, I was still pretty fit, but I was... Because I think someone said we were eating something like 4,500 calories a day, because the cold. I'm bearing in mind this is the winter time, you know, and you couldn't. We tried not to move around too much because it was bloody cold, you know. Very cold. If I ever remember anything about Korea, it's the cold. Last spotted memory is cold. I mean, you probably have to cut this out. But I was on the back of a three-tonner. I've just come back, I think, from a three-day leave in a place called Incheon. And you won't believe it, my hands were so cold, the guy next to me, actually, Michael Cohen, actually, he undid my zip so I could have a pee, you know what I mean? Because you used to zip, and then you had another flap and another thing, and you come down, you know. My hands were so cold.
Did anybody ever get frostbite?
Oh, you won't believe, I got frostbite in bloody Germany before I went to Korea. I got in my right foot, actually.
How did that happen?
Well, we were on a we used to go on these training weekends, you know, like schemes, and because you never took your boots off then, you know, and feet obviously got wet and they rubbed, and my toe came up me like a big blister, my right toe, and I was about 6 weeks in hospital, but I should have been less than that, but I was, because the hospital was nice, I used to keep picking the scab, you know, and they said, oh, you can't go yet because you're not healed. That old soldier's trick, you know.
But you didn't get frostbite in
Korea? No. Our gear was good, actually, very good. We used to have an insole. I've never seen them, and they were absolutely marvellous. We used to have a little, like, I suppose, like a plastic insole in the boot. And when every time you moved, you got friction from it, you know. It's only about 18 inches thick, I suppose. We had really good boots, you know. Not like the first guy. So, I mean, we split the guys from Middlesex now. I mean, they had no gear at all. They really had it rough, you know, those guys. The guys who come from Hong Kong, you know, in 50.
You mentioned Michael Caine, the actor, but at the time, did you realise that he had an acting career in front of him?
Yeah, actually, we did, because Mike, Maurice Joseph Mickle, as his real name is, I first met Mike when we were in Stoughton Barracks in Guildford, and bearing in mind, I'm talking about 1951, everyone used to, it was the fashion, everyone used to have very short haircuts, like what is called a crew cut or semi-crew cut, you know, very short hair. And I was on the staircase, it was the first day when we first came in, and this guy came in, I've got a photo, I'll show you in a minute. This guy came in with this long blonde hair, and he stuck out like a sore thumb, you know. And I made some remark, and he said, yeah, I get stuffed, or something like that, you know what I mean? only kidding, you know. And that's the way it started, like, you know, we were in the same barracks, same room, you know.
But was he specially allowed to wear his hair longer than other people?
No, that was the first day. Then we used to have a haircut. When we were in basic training, it was another fiddle, actually. With the sergeant and the local barber, he used to have a haircut every 5 days, and it cost us sixpence, which is what 2.5p now, I suppose. And it used to be marched down to the barber, and zoom, 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 all off, you know.
So his name actually isn't Michael Caine, then?
No, his real name is Maurice Joseph Micklewhite. And his dad was a professional soldier, actually. His dad was ended up as a fish porter, but his dad was in the First World War in the infantry at the end of the war, and then he went to India, and I think he came back from memory in the early 30s, and then he got caught up again and went into he's in the Royal Artillery. And actual fact, I'll show you the photograph, actually. His dad took a German belt off a German guy, and Mike used to wear it, actually, and I got a photograph of him wearing it, actually. When we were in Germany, Iserlohn, we were in the Luftwaffe barracks, and obviously all their little turnings and streets were all named after German air races, you know, and the Red Baron, Richthofen. That was our little place where we were in the barracks. First time I ever see triple glazing.
You told me about the casualties the rifle companies in Korea.
Yeah, yeah.
But were there many casualties to your machine gun unit?
No, we not while I was there. I did say my section sergeant was a professional soldier called Stan Burgess, actually. And it just shows you how things come back and haunt you, not haunt you, but come back and hit you. About a year ago, I was just talking to some guys, and I said, that blah blah Stan Burgess. Oh yes, yeah, he got done. He was with a rifle company. I said, what do you mean he got done? I said, a machine gun sergeant. So he said, the story transpired that they must have been short of a sergeant, and he's been volunteered or something, and they've gone out into the paddy. I think they've probably been doing listening patrol or something, and they've gone into this little shell scrap. There's five guys, including Stan, and they've lit up. Well, it's fatal, really, because you can see the flame for a long, long way. Crazy. And of course, the old gooks just stuck a couple of mortars down and killed the five of them. Bang. But I thought, you know, it really hits you, because when you're there and they get done, it's bad enough. But when I'm talking about sort of 1996, and you think that the guy's probably married, got grandchildren. You don't think of a young guy, you know, you think he'd be like me, sort of an old man. Well, not an old man, but, you know, getting on anyway. You think he'd have a good life, but because he's buried out there with 1,100 other guys, you know.
So, you told me how long you'd normally stay in the front line. How many sessions in the front line do you
twice.
Think that you might have had?
Twice I was in there. We had two turns in the line. We was pretty lucky because you said about the Queen's coronation. Well, we brought back the colour, regimental colour for the coronation on the troop ship in there, Sturious it was. I think I must have got home. When was it? I can't remember now. I never went to it anyway. I never went to it, couldn't be bothered. When was the coronation? You remember?
June 1953. That was.
Yeah, well, I was out by then. Yeah, because I was out in April or something. Yeah, April it came out.
So, you had the two sessions in the front line.
Yeah.
What were the differences between the first position and the second position that you were in?
Well, the second position was obviously a bit closer. You know, the first time in, you sort of everyone was sort of getting a feel of things, know what to expect. Second time was up closer, you know, closer in the line. I can't remember where we were now, actually, Territory. The rifle company guys are telling more about that, I think. Because all it meant to me, really, was firing positions, you know, because everywhere was charted. And, you know, we used to fire on such and such and just put it on a dial, so that, bang, bang, ways to go, you know.
And the first position was in the summer or autumn. And
that, yeah, so right, yeah.
And the second in Christmas time.
It was in the winter time.
Were there any particular songs that you sang in Korea?
Yeah, there was Japanese songs. Oh, you mean English songs even?
Any songs?
There was one or two Japanese songs, which is, getting back to music in Korea, in November 1952, I don't know if you're aware of it, but a guy called Hank Williams died. Hank Williams, obviously, was a very famous American singer. Hank. And I didn't know too much about it, actually, but we used to get the Stars and Stripes, and the Americans were really down about this guy dying. I thought, well, is he the president or what, you know? And then we started listening to the American songs, you know, and of course when the guys went on local leave, they or went to Tokyo, which I did as well, went a 5-day leave in Tokyo. We used to get these Japanese songs, you know, and the Korean songs too, come that. Which they still sing, actually. The Koreans always sing this when we go to the end of their dues, a song called Arirang. Don't ask me to sing because it's in Korean, you know. We never put any words to it anyway. A couple of Japanese songs, we put English words to it, you know. And actually, they come over as English songs, actually. One come over as Moon Over Malaya, I think, at the finish.
But nobody made up any songs.
Not to my knowledge. No, I never knew anyone that talented who could sort of was into it. I suppose some of the guys did. I mean, used to sing all the old classics, all the old Red River Valley, like, you know, and we were fighting for that so and so Sigma Marie and stuff like that, you know, other songs, but our own words to it, which most of the guys would know, I think. But what's this one McEwen sang, or can you remember it?
It starts off just below the Manchurian border.
Yeah. I can't. Yeah, if you give me the tune, I'll come. Yeah.
I'll sing it to you later.
Like, okay. Yeah.
Now, a bit later in your life, after you'd left the British Army in Korea, I think somehow you came to be in the New Zealand Army. Yeah,
just a quickie. When I left the army, I finished my apprenticeship, but I couldn't, like most of the guys, I couldn't settle. So I went away to sea. I went away with a P&O. I was away about 3 years, and in my travels, I went to New Zealand. I thought, well, you know, this is quite a tasty place. So. Plus the fact it was free. I mean, if you went to Aussie, it would cost you a tenner. If you went to New Zealand, it would cost you nothing. So a mate of mine, Jack Hayne, and we said, "What? Well, we go to Kiwi." And on the way down there, on the old Captain Cook, we sailed out of Glasgow. There were two other guys, and they were ex-military too, at the Hampshires, but called Mike Harris and Peter Sly. And we had this cabin. Oh, I went down to New Zealand. And to cut a long story short, I was quite matey with this Mike Harris. And just as our silly things are, we were on a railway station, and we were going for a job, and we saw this picture of a New Zealand guy with his old lemon squeezer on, you know, his hat. And I said, Mike, if we don't get this job, we join the Kiwi Army, because they were getting a battalion to go to Malaya. See? Says, yeah, okay, right, why not? So we didn't get the job, so we joined the Kiwi Army.
Which year was this?
This would be about 58. And
did you want to go to Malaya?
No, I didn't go anyway. No. No, all we did it for was that we. We didn't have a job, and the only thing we could do fairly well was soldiering. So we figured, well, we at least do the winter in the army. At least you got 3 meals and a flop, you know, 3 meals and a bed. And so we did that because we went to a place called Wairu, which is right in the middle of the North Island, and it was cold as Korea. It's a big ski resort, really, you know. And these Kiwis, they started putting these big packs on. I mean, 80 and 90 pound packs. I mean, that's a lot of weight, I tell you. They just toughen you up, you know. And we went into a place, just outside a place called Whanganui, where they used to do their jungle training. And they said, the sergeant, it was a Maori guy, actually, said, okay, he said, just go straight through, he said. And some of the guys were trying to keep their feet dry. He said, don't worry about it. He said, because we're staying here 4 weeks and you're going to get wet, you know. So everyone just, being an old soldier, I never wore socks anyway, you know. I just went straight through it, like, and we was wet for 4 weeks.
Did that have any bad effect on you?
Nah. Well, when you're young and strong, you don't worry about things like that, you know.
And was there much difference between the New Zealand Army and the British Army?
They had a different approach. They were more on soldiering. I mean, they did their bit of sort of, you know, sort of drill and stuff like that. Most of their stuff was on about weapons and full craft and things you'd need, you know, because they were going to Malaya anyway, you know. Whereas the British Army, our routine, you could work it out. You're in barracks and you'll have a battalion portrayed on a Friday, every Friday, a full battalion, and then you have a company parade every day, which you had to be, you know, arms drawn stuff. Whereas they would be, they'd say, well, we're soldiers, so they'd be out in the field. They'd be sort of, you know, doing like mini manoeuvres, as it were, you know.
Did they have parades at all in the
New Oh Year? Yeah, they had parades. Yeah, I mean, you always have a muster parade and stuff, you know. But they never took it too serious. I mean, they took it serious when it mattered. I mean, if there's any fighting to be done, the Kiwi, you know, was good because we had the 25 the New Zealand artillery with us in the Commonwealth. And anyone you speak to, but anyone, I mean, they were the tops, the best, without a doubt. They could eat anything with their 25 pounders, you know.
So, which do you think was the better system then, the British Army or the New Zealand Army?
New Zealand Army, without a doubt. Another story. I told you I had this bit of frostbite. Well, I had to go to Dokkervolland, and while I was going there, they said to me, "We'll pick up this sergeant No, he wasn't a sergeant then. Pick up this guy, he just done 3 months in a military detention place, you know. I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, I don't get involved with this, you know. They said, no, he's all right. He wants to go to Korea, because he was a guy, his idea of a soldier was a bit like mine. If you're going to be a soldier, you're going to go not marching up and down, as it were, you know what I mean? And I said to him, look, mate, I said, you know, I don't want any trouble. He said, no, I'll be no problem at all. He said, I just want to go back, so I just want to go do soldiering. I met him again in Korea after that, and he was a full sergeant. Boom, that's how good he was. He was a real pro, but he liked fighting patrols and you know, priming grenades and you know, throwing mortars around, you know. You get a lot of guys like that, actually. Guys you can't soldier in barracks, but who can soldier out, you know.
How long were you in the New Zealand Army for then?
Oh, I suppose about 7 or 8 months, actually.
So what kind of a contract did you sign?
Well, I did. I was quite friendly with the old man, like the colonel and just major, and I said, well, look, I can't hack this. I don't want to know. I met someone out, and I said, I want to get out. So he said, well, I don't know about that. I said, well, look, I can get from here to Australia in about 4 days. What is known as ring bolting. I could get on a ship, illegal, you know. He said, well, don't do that. He said, because he said it mess up the rest of your life. He said, just pay you 15 quid. He said, and buy yourself out, which I did do.
Just as easy as that.
Yeah, well, their attitude was, if you want a soldier, you can soldier. If you don't, you know. So the guys who soldiered there, they did soldier, you know. And when my mate Mick Harris wanted to do the same thing, he took about 4 months to get out. They wrote back home here too, because he gave them some cock and bull story about his dad being not well, you know, and they got in touch with Safra and everything, you know. And he got out eventually anyway.
But he loved you.
Yeah, Mike loved me. Yeah.
He tried to do it the hard way, really.
Yeah, he did. Well, I think they knew that I worked a flanker, actually, you know, because most of the non-coms in the New Zealand Army were British. We had a sergeant from the Scots Guards, Duncan Cameron, and he was a professional soldier, but he was a guardsman, you know. He was great on drill, but I'm not so sure about, you know, in the jungle. But I suppose he'd been all right, you know. And they'd all signed contracts because they'd all been brought over from Britain, you know. But I signed them in New Zealand, you know.
What does work a flanker mean?
Oh, pull a stroke. pull a stroke. Do something a bit, which is not quite legal, really, you know what I mean?
I've heard the phrase, but
yeah,
I didn't know what it meant.
Yeah, work a flanker, you know, pull a stroke, yeah.